This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield approval. If you qualify and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Now, you've probably already heard that it's Serena Williams at the U.S. Open final on Saturday. Williams was fined for multiple code violations, including verbal abuse of a chair umpire. Now, some observers are saying her emotion was unwarranted. Williams herself says the chair umpire treated her differently because she's a woman.
The fact that I have to go through this is just an example for the next person that has emotions and that want to express themselves and they want to be a strong woman. And they're going to be allowed to do that because of today. Maybe it didn't work out for me, but it's going to work out for the next person.
Well, the details of what happened in the match do matter, but they're not exactly where we're going to focus today, because we're going to talk about what the Serena debacle tells us about female anger in general. Is it treated differently? What happens when women express rage? Well, our guest says women ought to embrace their anger as a force for change. This hour on Point, the power of women's anger. Join us. When women get angry, are they treated differently than men? Why? And what's the effect of this? Is female anger something to be tamped down or celebrated? And women, how do you channel anger? Or maybe, how about this? Should we all work a little harder on being less full of rage? Well, joining me today from New York is Soraya Shamali. She's a writer, activist, and author of Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. She's also director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project, which aims to curb online abuse, increase media tech diversity, and expand women's freedom of expression. Soraya Shamali, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me, Meghna.
Okay, so let me just, since we started off with playing that Serena tape.
Yes.
Let me just get your thoughts. I mean, you know, what did you think about that moment? And then, of course, of the reaction that followed.
So, you know, it's always, to me, the reaction that follows that's most telling. I mean, you have an athlete at the top of her game in a super important match expressing very intense emotions. And you have a ref, an umpire, who has choices. And even tennis players have talked about the fact that in that situation, his role is to de-escalate, not to agitate. And it's really, in all of this commentary, you can watch it, but it comes down to almost a matter of opinion. Mm-hmm. And whether there's a double standard about her being expected to control herself, an expectation we know we have of women more than men are. And what's really remarkable to me, just 5 minutes ago, I saw that there are umpires who are saying that they will maybe refuse to officiate in her games.
Yeah.
And that's really gobsmacking. I mean, given the long history of bad boys and charismatic tennis players and the fascination with that in the men's field, hearing that from referees is quite stunning.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm seeing the news item here that that because some of the umpires are perceiving what they see as a lack of institutional support for the umpire who gave Williams that game penalty,
right,
that they're discussing possibly boycotting her matches.
Yes, that's right.
And I mean, maybe people will call in and correct me, but I don't think I've ever heard of something similar happening with many of the badly behaved male players we've seen over this many years.
Yeah, I'd be happy to hear if that's the case. I haven't seen or heard of that either. She was also levied the highest fine for verbal abuse in the U.S. Open. Mm. And over the past few days, you know, a lot of people have been sharing video compilations of men who play and are incredibly abusive, including using very obscene language or threats. And men have also come forward to say, you know, I've been treated I've treated umps even worse than that, referees worse than that, and I have never been penalized. And I think the issue here is that it comes down to this notion of subjectivity and that these people are in a position of power and that they can make these decisions. And the implicit biases that we know exist, right? The man could have had every correct intention, but no doubt in this context especially and with this player particularly – those biases come into play in ways that need to be put in context.
Yeah. Well, so let me play a little bit of this viral video now that's out there on social media. Facebook user Christopher Ates or Ates shared a 2-minute-long compilation of male tennis players getting furious, smashing their rackets, yelling at umpires. And again, this went viral. We're just going to play a little bit of part of it.
You're pathetic, you know that? You are the worst umpire that I've ever seen in my life. You're never going to work another match in 5 minutes. Come on! This is absurd! I can't believe this!
All right, well, that's part of this viral video. Again, it goes on for 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know, I have to say, Soraya, I want to apologize to you already because I'm like, I'm stumbling over my words in this hour already, more so than I usually do, in part because this is... I don't think I've met a woman yet, and I'm going to include myself in this group, that hasn't had to grapple with this somehow. It is, and there's a diversity of opinion, of course, even amongst women about whether or not anger is a positive animating force or should be.
Right.
So I just want to ask you for your forgiveness in advance because I'm not quite sure where to go. It's something that I face all the time.
Well, I think we all do, right? Because we really understand from a very early age what the risks and costs of our displaying full emotions and particularly this emotion are. And we're not misunderstanding the situation. I mean, study after study after study shows that when men display anger, it reaffirms gender norms. It reaffirms masculinity. And so there are rewards for doing that. They gain power from doing that. Even if it's ugly and uncomfortable and causes people distress, they are not penalized in the same ways. When women do it, it actually transgresses. So we violate gender norms. And we end up being powerless in that situation. And I think that even a woman like Serena Williams, in the situation she was in, expressing anger in the way she did, was an example of how that works. I mean, the fact that an entire body of people who are mainly men who are still officiating at these games feel threatened by this sufficiently that they would say that they're going to withdraw is something we are all familiar with. It's almost like the tennis version of men saying we don't want to be Me Too'd, so we're going to pick up our toys and go away.
Mm. You know, and it's so interesting because I feel like frequently not only do women, okay, speaking for myself here, but not only do women they feel this compulsion to manage the expression or even the experience of their own anger. But then on top of that, as you were just saying, there's also the duty to manage its effect on others and the potential response that you could get in return. And you can't really ever, A, control other people's responses or, B, predict what they are. I mean, I'm looking here on Facebook and we've got the whole range of responses just as Serena. I mean, someone calling themselves Hassan Askari says, totally double standard at its worst. Whereas Hans Rosenschwein says, unsportsmanlike conduct is not women's empowerment. If you don't want to follow the rules, play the game without rules. But he did it too is a 5-year-old's argument.
So that's funny, right? Because sometimes the rules are poorly written and they're based entirely on a way of life that we no longer lead. And I would argue that this is maybe an example of that. I mean, the sort of rage-filled outburst that, as it's been described, that happened over the weekend, it doesn't stand in isolation. There's this penchant, I think, to decontextualize all of this. I mean, this woman's entire career has been plagued with double standards and inconsistencies and sort of policing of her body and her expression. And so in addition to playing a game at a very high level that is fraught with emotion, and we're supposed to pretend it's not, but of course it is. We see that every day. She has to be living this double consciousness and triple consciousness. We're talking about sexism, but in fact it's sexism and racism that we're talking about, and that becomes a complicated equation for many people. But she has to live with that equation. And so, you know, the rules as they are written is a common fallback, but that's not really a useful framing for this because we know that the rules as they were written were more or less created for a pretty small elite group of men who tended to be white. It was a very genteel sport. And even 20 years ago, John McEnroe said, this is absurd. We can't play that way anymore. We have these emotions. We feel powerful and passionate.
Well, so let's get right to sort of the one of the animating aspects of your book here. The book is Rage Becomes Her. The subtitle is The Power of Women's Anger. So you see the women's anger, women's rage as powerful. How?
So we talked a lot about this, and we didn't qualify power for a reason. It can be immensely negatively powerful, the impact it has on our mental lives, on our physical well-being, on our relationships. But what I really want to focus on is that we have that sense in the culture. We have an emotional culture that thinks of that thinks of anger as destructive and as negative, when in fact it's the way we perceive and manage anger that yields these bad effects. So I want to be able to consider the ways in which this emotion, which we all have as humans, is equally leverageable for good. And so I provide examples of that in the book and talk about both the ways in which it hurts us and the ways in which it can so powerfully help us.
Mm. So, but are you saying that the default presumption about how that anger is leveraged when it's expressed by women is that it's that the presumption is that it's a force for no, it's not a force for good?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that it's very clear, and you know, I think we could probably talk about this for days on end with virtually any woman we know, that when we articulate anger, when we display anger, that's not particularly welcome, either interpersonally, professionally, or politically. And so we're always, as you described, calibrating ourselves not only to managing our own emotions, but because we're socialized to do this, managing the emotions and responses of the people around us. Mm. And that starts really early. I mean, little girls by the age of 7 or 8 are being urged 3 times more than boys to use their nice voices.
Wow. Well, Soraya Shamali joins us. She's a writer, activist, and author. And her new book is Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. By the way, we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Want to know what you think. I mean, do you think women's anger, women's rage can be a powerful force, a force for good? Maybe that's what we're seeing here with a lot of renewed women's activism. Or also want to know if maybe we should all work a little harder on not feeling so angry. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. States and MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with Soraya Shamali. She is author of the new book, Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. And we're talking about female anger and how it's been viewed, how it is viewed in society, whether or not it can be a force for good or perhaps not. Soraya, in a minute, I want to talk to you about a couple of specific examples of women speaking out about their anger. But there was something that you said in the previous segment that I just wanted to follow up on really quickly. And that has to do with when frequently that when men express their anger or frustration or rage, that it can be seen as powerful, right? But when women do so, they take the risk of behaving in a way where perhaps overstepping their bounds, right? That they're presuming to have a power by just simply being angry that maybe observers don't think they should have.
Right. A lot of studies really indicate that men are much more likely to associate anger with power and women to associate it with powerlessness. And I think that is because that's how we tend to experience this emotion. We can't really control whether we feel angry or not. We can control what we do about the feeling, how we behave in the wake of the feeling. But that aspect of saying, let's just not feel angry, doesn't really work. It doesn't work for men and it doesn't work for women because the anger will always find a way. And so when women express anger, regardless of how they are expressing it, they can tiptoe around people. They can use really nice words. The fact is that they are making an assertion that something should change and that they are demanding that people around them do something. And in so doing, they're breaking connections and they're challenging traditional status quo hierarchies. And that matters even in intimacy. It matters in intimacy. It matters, you know, in politics. And so that quality of saying, I'm angry, I think is vitally important because what we're saying is I have knowledge. We don't associate anger with knowledge. And Audre Lorde said this years ago, anger is filled with information. And so when we shut down somebody's anger, we are literally silencing the knowledge that they have and saying it's not useful to us as a social resource.
But it's the fact of the demand for change, right?
Yes.
Which may be what the anger is projecting. Oftentimes, the response that's met is one of, well, you're being disrespectful, you're being presumptuous, you know.
Yes, you're being uppity, or you're being rude, or you're really not being nice, or what is that tone of voice? And, you know, there are all of these minimizing words for our anger. We're irritated, maybe we're stressed. We have millions of words that convey the feeling of anger without ever actually recognizing it in the word anger. And we know that there are all kinds of insults and slurs that go along with that for women.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick call here. Beth is calling from Natick, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Beth.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call, and I'm really excited to read the book. The point that I was hoping your guest could touch on is the idea of women sort of being empowered by their relationship to others. For instance, mothers, we hear a lot about if women get together as mothers or they assert their role as mothers to express righteous anger and to demand change, that's somehow seen as much more kind of valid, I think, by a lot of people in society because that's their proper relational role, whereas men can be angry about things on their own as individuals and they're not defined by their relationship.
Right.
Yes, that is such a good point.
Specifically with Serena, she said, you know, I'm a mother, I would never cheat, I'm not showing this to my daughter, and I'm pretty sure John McEnroe never talked about any of his six kids in protesting his tennis referee judgment. So,
Beth, thank you for your call. I mean, Saraya Shamali, I think it's a really interesting point. Like, it's okay to be a mama bear, but you can't actually be angry on your own behalf.
That's right. And this is such a critical point in our culture in particular. And Beth really hit the nail on the head. We see in politics, we see this all the time. If you're a conservative woman politician, that mama bear narrative is front and center right away. But generally speaking, we have these immense political movements. You know, you can think of the temperance movement where women were talking about public drunkenness, but what they were really talking about was the fact that men were getting drunk, wasting their money, abusing their families. And so they could do that they would frame it in a different way, but we know that you have things like the Children's Defense Fund, Moms Against Drunk Driving, Moms Rising, mothers working for gun control. It's almost as though we have to put this idea that we are nurturers and reproducers front and center to be allowed to articulate ourselves in any way politically. And so if you're a single child-free person and you are a woman as an individual, what are you supposed to do with that, right? What is the point of validation there? And so if a woman expresses anger as a mother or in a maternal role or a nurturing role as a teacher, for example, or a nurse, it conforms with our idea of what women should be doing.
Yeah.
But if we break outside of those roles, it becomes much more friction-filled.
So, Soraya, though, can I just, since you mentioned the temperance movement, I mean, isn't that also a complicated example, though? Because here, you know, even given what you said, people can look at that as and saying, well, that is an example of how the the outcomes of the actions produced by that anger weren't a great idea. It all had to be undone in the 21st Amendment.
It had to be, and it was super complicated, and it reflected the deep history, too, of our history of racism and the fracturing of social movements. And so, yes, I mean, I don't think any of this is simple. I think we still see this. I mean, I write in the book about how the anger of white women is leveraged against black people in this country, and it has been for centuries. And so we need to have the consciousness of what that means and how that anger operates, yeah. whether it's being tapped into to support the idea of a strong protective man, or whether it's been tapped into to support social policies that really only help a small percentage of the population of women in the country.
Well, let's go to Teresa, who's calling from Farmington Hills, Michigan. You're on the air, Teresa.
Hi. I was thinking this diva mentality is just annoying to me, whether it's McEnroe or Serena, a man or woman. You know, I know it's a lot of show, because that's what people do. They go to hockey games, see fights and all that. But she wouldn't have got fined if she would have diplomatically said how she felt. I mean, I know we all get angry, but this, I don't think we should feed the fire of women's anger. I think everybody's angry enough in this America,
yeah.
you know?
Teresa, thank you so much for your call. Soraya, before I let you respond, I mean, we have a comment very much along those lines coming in on our website. Someone calling themselves John Locke. If that's your real name, John, you're lucky. Or you're taking the name of the English philosopher. But John Locke says, I'm always suspicious of people advocating for negative emotions like fear and anger. You hear this from time to time on the left where you get motivated, you need to get angry, which is understandable. But fear and anger are the exact same emotions that lead us to the most ugly moments in our history.
So this is, I think, even in the framing of that, there is just the presumption that the anger is negative. It's just an emotion. It is actually a human emotion. It's neutral on its own grounds, right? It is a signal that something is wrong. We would not be here today. We would not be alive if we didn't have this emotion, because it is the warning that we are facing a risk or a threat. So in and of itself, I think we just need to respect that about that particular emotion. But it can be equally related to contempt and disgust and fear, which we see, for example, in the fuel for authoritarian beliefs, or social justice movements. Anger is as compassionate, as empathetic, as powerfully sympathetic as love can be. And so that's the kind of distinction I think we need to make to just shut down the entire fact of the emotion and say it's bad, we don't want to curry anger, isn't particularly helpful, I don't think. We don't want people to be raging. That's also a terrible mismanagement. What we need is for people to consider what their anger is telling them and then to strategize about how to utilize that anger.
Okay, so that's exactly... Oh, I'm so glad you said that, because, you know, I'm looking at John's last thoughts in this comment saying, you know, that same emotions that lead us to ugly moments in our history. And I think, you know, one of the things I see him getting at, or her, whoever John Locke is, saying that, you know, anger in and of itself, whether or not the emotion is something we should pass judgment on, it is volatile, it is unpredictable, and it can be, you know, harnessed or manipulated for good or for bad. So to what you were just saying, Soraya, how do we then, you know, if you're advocating to channel it into a powerful force for good or for,
yes.
for social justice, how?
So I think a few things. Anger becomes volatile and unpredictable when it hasn't actually been addressed, right? So you can feel a deep, unsettling rage that accrues over time, right? Because you have difficult life circumstances. You are dealing with many, many different things at once. You can see social inequality affecting your life, whatever the source may be. But if that anger remains unaddressed, that is how we end up with explosive rage. And so that kind of mismanagement is as critical to understand as the mismanagement that results in suppression of anger or diversion of anger. And either way, either extreme requires thinking hard about your feelings, which can be very difficult. It means being honest with yourself and with other people, which, again, can be very difficult. And so I'm not suggesting it's easy to do this, but I am suggesting that it's necessary that we do this.
Well, let's take a call. Sonia's calling from Bel Air, Maryland. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
You're most welcome. What's your thought today?
I just wanted to make the point that my husband's retired Army officer, and a lot of the time that we've been in the military, I've been called perhaps aggressive, maybe too loud, because frankly, as an Army wife, I've had to be. My husband's gone. You know, my husband calls it moving, shooting, and communicating. This is what we do to get the job done. And all of my friends, my Army wives, are exactly like that. But we are called these negative words, and sometimes if a man was like that, he's powerful and he's strong, where I'm kind of doing the same thing, and, you know, I'm a little bit too aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
I will also say, though, that we have two daughters that we're raising. One of them is an ROTC cadet. She's going to be an Army nurse, and certainly she's going into a man's world where she's going to have to be a little bit more aggressive also. And hopefully she won't, you know, get that kind of negative backlash that we've seen because, you know, in the Army, they have male nurses, they have female nurses, and we're all kind of just trying to work together,
yeah,
you know, to make it work. But I absolutely, you know, I'm so glad that when I was in the car, I heard this program because I see it every day that if you are a strong woman that speaks her mind and talks about how things aren't fair, then maybe you're just complaining and whining.
Right.
Whereas if a man was doing that, it's absolutely different.
Well, Sonia, thank you so much for your call. Soraya, did you want to respond to Sonia?
I would like to because I think she's describing a very common problem, which is that this idea that we're one-dimensional as women and that having full display of these human emotions is problematic in the society. And one aspect of that is that we conflate girls and women's assertiveness, aggression, and anger. That all falls into one big bucket for a lot of people.
Right. There's no nuance there.
Yeah. Right. And so you can be, you know, anger is an emotion. Aggression is the type of behavior. And so even in childhood, we see girls who are assertive. They're not angry. They're defending themselves or they're defending an opinion, and they are easily dismissed or mocked or categorized as over-emotional or whiny or complaining. And that carries through adulthood. And so making that distinction between assertion, anger, and aggressiveness is important. And I will say one thing about the current political situation that I wish we talked more about, which is that we now have a generation of girls and women who benefited from Title IX. And we think of Title IX mainly in terms of sports equality. But in fact, it's a central aspect of women's leadership. And having gone through sports, particularly team sports, we have a generation of women who learned about physical aggression in a different way, who learned to regulate the way they behaved and how they used their anger or their bodies. And I think that's a very important political moment.
Well, you know what? I want to play a little bit of tape here. Speaking of political moments, this is from the Women's March, January 2017 in Washington. It became the largest single day protest in the history of the United States.
I'm angry. I am outraged.
Hear us roar! Hear us roar!
I am a nasty woman.
This is what feminism looks like.
We have a chance, brothers and sisters, to get this thing right. We can do it. If women rise up and take this nation back.
It's from the Women's March in Washington in 2017, January. Soraya Shamali, I mean, I think what one of the many remarkable things about this piece of sound that we just played is the unabashed expression that, you know, we heard Madonna there at the top saying, "I'm here because I am angry."
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, is that, you were talking about the political moment that we're in, on the one hand with Serena Williams maybe getting pushback for expressing her anger on the court, but on the other hand, we are having very public displays of female rage.
That's right. And I am grateful for women who speak publicly in those ways because they incur a lot of costs for doing that. I mean, all you have to really do is look at, I mean, Ashley Judd was your second clip there. And, you know, she can't speak. She can't say what she said without weeks of harassment, abuse and threats. Weeks. I mean, it just, you see it filtered through all of her social media, for example. And so making the decision to stand up out loud and say, I'm angry, I'm a woman, I have the right to be angry, is important. It's important for us to have role models that do that. But I find, too, that it's interesting because what we're really dealing with today politically is how we think of citizenship. Who gets to be a citizen? Who gets to claim rights? Who gets to say, these politics are my politics? And historically, a very small group of people have been identified with full American citizenship. And so we see that anger, like Tea Party anger, was righteous, right? We could understand that. But what we have here is a new feminized version of that.
Well, we're speaking with Soraya Shamali. She's author of the new book, Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. Want to hear from you about what you think about women's anger. If you're a woman who's expressed that anger and if you had blowback from that, or do you think there's a double standard or not? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes the most important things need a hype squad.
Corporate.
Income.
Income.
Tax.
Corporate income tax!
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy. A very enthusiastic podcast about the economy.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking with Soraya Shamali. She is a writer, activist, and author. Her new book is Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. And Soraya, you will not be surprised to know that we're getting a lot of comments about this conversation. I just want to read you a couple of them and tons of callers too. So I'll get to you folks who are very patiently waiting on the line in just a second. But here's a little selection of what's been coming in. On Twitter, someone calling themselves The Jag or The Jag, I guess, says, I do not care what your profession is or who you are. You do not get to yell at me. Being angry does not mean you have to be rude and disrespectful. Politics Watcher says, is frustration the same as anger? Is fed-upness the same as anger? Vegan Gal in Nola says, frustration is a fact of life. The goal should be to not explode. I oftentimes feel annoyed with others much more than I feel angry. Anger kills, even if it feels good at the moment. What do you think?
So I would say I agree with all of that. I don't think that people have a right to be uncivil or rude or cruel. I think that it's everyone's responsibility to try and cultivate conversations that are important. And yelling and screaming and throwing things doesn't do that. And actually, studies show that even things like anger rooms are really problematic because it causes rumination and it doesn't actually address the cause of what's fueling the anger. I also think that this directly addresses something that someone said earlier, which is, I'm not for putting more rage into the world. And I want to make one point about this, which is the point of the book, really. The rage is here. The question is, what is happening to it? So you don't have to see rage in these explosive moments to understand that for many people, the anger that they feel is material in their bodies, and it's material in their daily lives. And that consumes us. It consumes us as a society because we have terrible health outcomes. We have terrible gender norms that are related to those health outcomes. And that affects virtually every dimension of our lives. So to say that we don't want to put more rage into the world miscategorizes, I think, the situation at hand. People are angry, and the anger is either hurting them or hurting other people. And so we need better understanding of the emotion and what to do with it.
Mm. And it does not help when you're telling 50% of the people out there that that rage that you feel, that you, as you said, that is already there, that you should not feel it, that that response is wrong, that
that's
it,
right.
that it's unbecoming or inappropriate.
That's right. And also, it's not just that that's what women are being told. It is they are actively penalized for it. So there was a study earlier this year of courtroom dynamics that essentially showed that when a male lawyer uses anger or feels anger, or displays anger, for example, in closing statements, he inspires confidence. He's much more likely to get the support of the jury. His female pair doing the exact same thing has the opposite response. And that dynamic, that power accruing to masculine anger, powerlessness accruing to feminine anger, is evident in many different contexts. Mm. And so that quality of punitiveness for violating your place, your gender rules, is very, very prominent in our lives.
Yeah. Well, let's go to our patient callers here. Marlene is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Marlene, you're on the air.
Hi, I appreciate you taking my call. We're sitting here waiting for the hurricane to hopefully not hit us too hard.
Yeah.
I'll start by saying I'm a nurse of 32 years and an attorney of 10, and I attended the Women's March with my son in hopes of going to the inauguration and seeing Hillary. And instead, we spent the day at the African American History Museum, which was a beautiful way to spend that day. And then we attended the Women's March. I subsequently changed my Facebook profile picture to the American Eagle with the pink pussy hat on it. And it has become a trigger for white males in my neighborhood on our neighborhood Facebook page that I can't ever post anything without someone saying the most hateful, defamatory thing in response to me.
Marlene, do you mind if I interrupt you? I'm so sorry to have to do that, but your phone line is very, very spotty. And I think we heard a lot of that, and maybe we'll blame it on Hurricane Florence. First of all, I hope you're doing okay in Charleston, South Carolina, and hang in there. But Soraya Shamali, you just heard Marlene saying that that she can't comment on her neighborhood Facebook pages because of how men react, because she had put imagery from the Women's
yes.
March on her Facebook page.
So, first of all, I also hope, Marlene, that your family is safe. This is just an immense storm. Thank you for taking the time to call in today. And I want to also say that in the book, I talk a lot about nursing. And I talk a lot about nursing because it's a petri dish of the much bigger problems that we face. Nurses have immense workplace stress. They are dealing with hierarchies, and they're dealing with regulation of their own emotions and other people's emotions 24/7. They have some of the highest rates of stress and burnout, and what those dynamics have to say about the larger dynamics is really important. Secondly, I think that a lot of the work that I have done in for many years is related directly to the threats and the harassment that Marlene described. What happened, if you saw in the wake, in the buildup to the election and in the wake of the election, was that women would say things, political things. They would freely express themselves, and they would often suffer from this barrage of hostility and very misogynistic and often racist hostility. And so they ceded the public space and moved into private groups. Mm. And we saw some huge private groups established in the last 3 years where women basically said, you know what? It is not worth this. This level of hostility, this risk that I face is not tenable. So we're gonna go into these women-only spaces. And I think, too, that it's impossible for me to know what Marlene's ethnicity is, but when, if, for example, the Women's March had a lot to do with the question of how race and ethnicity are related to feminism.
Mm-hmm.
And very often when a white woman breaks with whiteness, there is a lot of pushback to that. So we have a long history of that being considered a race betrayal. And those ideas are just deeply rooted in violent supremacy, right? White male supremacy, hate movements. And so what she just described to me is an aspect of that.
Yeah. Well, let's take another call here. Sean is calling from Tampa, Florida. You're on the air, Sean.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm part of the transgender community where I live. I am not myself transgender, but I know a lot of the people in that community. And so I've had the privilege of watching a number of people transition. And one thing that you often see is their way of communicating changes. And so, like, I have two friends personally who transitioned from female to male. And, like, I've gotten to watch their communication styles change. And one of them was commenting to me the other day that they no longer feel like they need to use their nice voice all the time.
Right.
And, you know, as a male growing up, you know, I never had a nice voice. And, like, I've now heard from a lot of other women, like, they have a nice voice. They have a voice that they use when they're angry, but they don't want to show it. And, like, that was mind-blowing to me. And, like, that people who transition into this new gender role have new allowances for what emotions they're allowed to feel and what emotions they're allowed to show.
Right. Sean, thank you so much for your call. Soraya, really interesting observation there, I think.
I'm so grateful that you called. There's so much that has been written about what you just described, and it's important, really, to listen to the words of people who've gone through this transition and had these experiences, because it speaks so deeply to how rooted in gender stereotypes our emotions are. We tend to think of emotions as internal and personal. It's individual. You experience it. Maybe you interact with someone. But in fact, these emotions are really socially constructed, and the way they're perceived and regulated just puts that on display. And the examples you just gave show exactly that. There was a scientist who wrote about this. It's transitioned from Barbara Baras as a student to Ben, and he wrote about what it meant not to be interrupted, not to be tone policed, to be considered just simply by speaking authoritative. And I think that those experiences are very important for us to talk about. And they do speak to one other aspect of this. I'm sort of using this binary framework, men, women, male, female. But I want to stress that in actuality, what we're talking about is femininity and masculinity. And so if you are a woman who displays a lot of masculine attributes that we tend to associate with men overwhelmingly, you are more likely to have an anger style that is thought of as man-like. Whereas if you are a man who has more feminine attributes, if you are in a nurturing role, for example, your anger style is going to be more what we think of as quote-unquote naturally a woman's. And that just goes to show how the ideas about gender are shaping behavior more than the biology of the emotion.
Yeah. Well, let's take another call. Tina is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Tina.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for taking my call, and welcome to On Point. I just have one quick question for Soraya about what I understand a little bit from anger, and that sometimes it can be misplaced sadness, deep sadness that people feel, but it's safer and easier to be angry than to be sad. And I want to also say that I completely agree with a caller earlier in the show that we need no more anger in America.
Well, Tina, thank you for your call. Soraya, your response to that, that anger could be misplaced sadness?
Yes, this is a really important distinction, and I spend a fair amount of time in the book talking about it. We, from very early age, adults and parents will attribute sadness to girls instead of anger. And they will attribute anger to boys instead of sadness. And so we end up with a lot of little boys who are never really taught about emotionality in general, although they are told about anger, and they learn to associate masculinity and being a real man with this emotion of anger. Whereas girls, parents and adults will talk to them and will reward them for displaying sadness or anxiety, but shut down their anger. So neither of those models is good for anyone. For little boys, that means they tend to grow up to be people who either hurt themselves, so you see high rates of suicide, or they hurt other people. And for girls, it means that all of this anger becomes subsumed and diverted into extremely unhealthy habits, and that might lead to, you know, it might contribute to anxiety or eating disorders or depression. But there is a really important distinction between these two words and what they mean, because sadness is a much more passive emotion. It does not make demands on the world in the way that anger does. Anger suggests some element of control. And that goes back to a very, very simple binary of how we think of boys and girls, men and women, which is that we think more of boys and we teach boys more about being individuals and being agentic and asserting themselves on their environments. But we tend to teach girls to be affiliative and connecting with other people and communal. And so those two things, the anger and the sadness, really should be ungendered. Boys and men need to be able to express sadness.
Right. But can I just say, I mean, I'm questioning your assertion that sadness doesn't make demands on the world. It can be seen as an emotion of withdrawal, for sure.
Yes.
But you know, for everyone who's experienced the sadness of a friend or a loved one, I mean, that does make demands on others in the circle of people who care about them.
Yes, I agree with you. I think, though, that if you think about how we perceive sadness, right, how we portray sadness versus how we perceive and portray anger, I'd still say that the distinction remains. It would be great if we understand how sadness operates. What I wrote about sadness is that people who are sad actually have much greater empathy for those around them. They tend to be more charitable. There are real virtues to how sadness is used by the people experienced it. I don't want to denigrate it or say that for some reason it's not a good or bad or unuseful emotion. But the ways in which people act when they're sad and when they're angry tend to be very different.
Yeah. I just want to play one last piece of tape here in this conversation. We have great producers on point. They've actually given me a ton of really great tape that I haven't played. But one last one here. This is Uma Thurman last fall when Access Hollywood asked her for a response to, you know, all the allegations against Harvey Weinstein and Me Too and sexual abuse in Hollywood. And here's Uma Thurman's response.
I have learned that when I've spoken in anger, I usually regret the way I express myself. So I've been waiting to feel less angry. And when I'm ready, I'll say what I have to say.
Soraya, we've got a minute left to go here, but is this an example of where her choice to not express her anger was expression enough?
Yes. I mean, I think it was. I mean, I don't think you could have heard her or seen her and not felt palpably the thrumming of rage that she was displaying without saying a word. It was quite amazing to watch the level of restraint involved in saying, I'm not going to do this for you. I'm not putting this on display for you.
But, I mean, it seems as if is one of the messages of your book that someone like Uma Thurman shouldn't have to feel like she should wait to feel less angry?
Well, I mean, I'm not too keen on telling people how they should feel or behave, but yeah. I do think that a woman in her position who has harbored these feelings and had these experiences but never been able to talk about them has the right to say, this made me mad.
Well, Soraya Shamali is director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project, which aims to curb online abuse, increase media and tech diversity, and expand women's freedom of expression. Her new book is Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Soraya Shamali, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Meghna.
And listeners, thank you for your calls and your comments. Keep them coming online at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.